Lecture number 4, The Basic Structure of the U.S. Constitution and Federalism. The Constitution is broken down into 7 articles. Article 1 establishes the legislative branch of the federal government, sets forth its rules of operation, and in Section 8, it sets forth Congress's various legislative powers. Not only does it affirmatively grant Congress certain legislative powers, it also prescribes certain powers both to the federal Congress and to the states in Sections 9 and 10. Article 2 establishes the executive branch of the federal government, sets forth its rules of operation, and sets forth the powers it is granted. Article 3 establishes the judicial branch of the federal government, sets forth its rules of operation, including impeachment proceedings, sets forth its jurisdiction, and defines treason. Article 4, 1, recognizes the states as co-governing authorities within our constitutional system, 2, imposes certain mandates and prohibitions against them, like the full faith and credit provision regarding the recognition of official acts from other states, the Privileges and Immunities Clause regarding how the laws of a particular state apply to citizens who come from other states, and rules regarding extradition. Third, it imposes rules regarding the admission of new states into the Union. Fourth, it imposes rules regarding congressional powers over territories that have not yet become states. And 5, it declares the obligation of the federal government to A, guarantee the various states a republican form of government, B, protect them from foreign invasion, and C, when asked by state officials for help, to help them quell domestic violence within the various states. Article 5 sets forth the rules regarding how the Constitution can be amended. No fleeting democratic whims will count, but rather, all amendments must garner supermajority support, meaning 2/3 of Congress and 3/4 of the states. Article 6 provides, 1, that the newly formed federal government under the Constitution will assume all the debts of the former federal government incurred under the Articles of Confederation. 2, contains the Supremacy Clause, requiring states to comply with all constitutional federal law, including treaties with foreign governments. 3, requires all federal and state officials to take oaths to support the Constitution. And 4, prohibits any federal religious test from being administered as a precondition for holding federal office. Article 7 sets forth the rules regarding the ratification process and provides that once 9 of the original 13 states vote to adopt the U.S. Constitution, it will become effective regarding those 9 and all the others which later adopt it. This lecture will focus on the constitutional sharing of governing powers between the federal government and the various states, which is generally referred to as federalism. Major subheading, The Federalist Papers. When the Constitution was finalized and sent to the National Congress and the states for adoption, some states were thought to be linchpin states. In other words, if any of them rejected it, the worry was that it would cause a stampede away from adoption. One of those states was New York. The influential governor of New York was publicly opposed to adoption. Alexander Hamilton, one of the New York delegates to the Constitutional Convention, took it upon himself to try to sway public opinion in New York in favor of adoption. He started submitting articles to the New York papers under the pen name of Publius. This series of articles analyzed the language of the Constitution and indicated what it would do and what it would not do. Hamilton did not write all of the articles. John Jay wrote 5 of them, James Madison about 30, and Hamilton about 50. Nobody knew who the authors were initially, but the articles generated much debate in New York and in the various other states where the articles were reprinted. They were eventually compiled as a set and called the Federalist Papers, or sometimes they are simply referred to as the Federalist. The group of people who were in favor of adoption were called Federalists, while those who were against passage were called Anti-Federalists. Concerning the perceived stature of the Federalist Papers, consider the following comments about them. Thomas Jefferson said they were, quote, the best commentary on the principles of government which has ever been written, end quote. Chief Justice John Marshall, speaking for a unanimous U.S. Supreme Court, said, quote, the Federalist is a complete commentary on our Constitution and is appealed by all parties in the question to which that instrument has given birth. Its intrinsic value entitles it to its highest rank. And the part 2 of its authors performed in framing the Constitution put it very much in their power to explain the views with which it was framed, end quote. Of course, he was referring there to both Madison and Hamilton. James Madison observed, quote, "The Federalist may fairly enough be regarded as the most authentic exposition of the text of the Federal Constitution as understood by the body which prepared and the authority which accepted it," end quote. Major subtopic, the principal theme of these papers was limited federal authority. The Anti-Federalists worried that the Constitution would create too strong of a central government and destroy state sovereignty. In order to refute their arguments, the prime theme of the Federalist Papers was the notion of limited delegated authority to the federal government. The Federalist Papers were, in effect, the intellectual sales pitch behind adoption and were quoted widely by the Supreme Court during the first 150 years of our nationhood. Such quoting, however, became much rarer from the New Deal period onwards as the Supreme Court veered sharply away from core precepts expounded in the Federalist. Major subheading, separation of powers and checks and balances. Although it wasn't until many years later that Lord Acton coined his oft-quoted phrase, quote, "power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely," unquote, the framers of our Constitution believed the same thing, and were very deliberate in trying to avoid such problems in our country. More than any government before, they took great pains to diffuse political power as much as possible in order to avoid despotism and tyranny. When we hear the terms separation of powers and checks and balances, most Americans today only think of the three branches of government at the federal level, namely the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. While such a conceptualization is partly true, it is incomplete because it refers only to the horizontal aspect of these terms, that is, checks and balances and separation of powers within only one level of government. These terms, however, also have a vertical aspect known as federalism, or the distribution of the various governing powers between the federal and state governments. Federalism refers to a system in which the powers of government are shared between a central or national government, often referred to in our country as the federal government, and smaller constituent units in our system called states. The quotations which follow indicate how some of the principal figures of the founding generation viewed the topic of federalism. Thomas Jefferson said, quote, "Our country is too large to have all its affairs directed by a single government. The true theory of our Constitution is surely the wisest and best, that the states are independent as to everything within themselves and united as to everything respecting foreign nations. Let the general government be reduced to foreign concerns only, and our general government may be reduced to a very simple organization, and a very inexpensive one, a few plain duties to be performed by a few servants," end quote. Jefferson also said, quote, "The way to have good and safe government is not to trust it all to one, but to divide it among the many, distributing to everyone exactly the functions he is competent to. Let the national government be entrusted with the defense of the nation and its foreign and federal relations, the state governments with the civil rights, laws, police, and administration of what concerns the state generally, the counties with the local concerns of the counties, and each ward direct the interests within itself. It is by dividing and subdividing these republics from the great national one down through all its subordinations, until it ends in the administration of every man's farm by himself, by placing under every one what his eye may superintend, that all will be done for the best. What has destroyed liberty and the rights of man in every government which has ever existed under the sun? The generalizing and concentrating all cares and powers into one body," end quote. James Madison said, quote, "The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite," end quote. In Federalist No. 39, Madison said that the federal government's, quote, "jurisdiction extends to certain enumerated objects only and leaves to the several states a residuary and inviolable sovereignty over all other objects," end quote. Major subheading, the taxing and spending power under the General Welfare Clause. Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution delineates the powers delegated to the National Congress. The entire section is but one long sentence. Contained within it are both the General Welfare and the Necessary and Proper clauses. In Federalist No. 41, Madison said that the opponents of the Constitution fiercely attacked the open-endedness of the power to tax and spend for the general welfare of the U.S. They argued this amounted to an unlimited delegation of power. Madison said that they were misconstruing that section. He explained, quote, "Shall the more doubtful and indefinite terms, in other words, the terms general welfare and necessary and proper, be retained in their full extent, and the clear and precise expressions, in other words, the specific Article 1, Section 8 delineations of power, be denied any significance whatsoever? For what purpose could the enumeration of particular powers be inserted if these and all others were meant to be included in the preceding general power? Nothing is more natural nor common than first to use a general phrase and then to explain and qualify it by a recital of particulars. But the idea of an enumeration of particulars which neither explain nor qualify the general meaning and can have no other effect than to confound and mislead is an absurdity." End quote. He further said that if the specific delegations of authority do not limit the import of the prior general phrase regarding the, quote, general welfare, end quote, then it gives Congress, quote, the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever, end quote. Any student of history of these times would conclude that such a proposition would never have had any chance of passage if put to a specific vote. Madison's logic is quite sound here. Jefferson agreed with Madison. He said, quote, "Congress had not unlimited power to provide for the general welfare, but were restrained to those specifically enumerated, and that, as it was never meant that they should provide for that welfare but by the exercise of the enumerated powers, so it could not have been meant they should raise money for purposes which the enumeration did not place under their action. Consequently, that the specification of powers is a limitation of the purposes for which they may raise money," end quote. He also said, quote, "To consider the General Welfare Clause as giving a distinct and independent power to do any act they, Congress, please, which might be for the good of the Union, would render all the preceding and subsequent enumerations of power completely useless. It would reduce the whole instrument to a single phrase, that of instituting a Congress with power to do whatever would be for the good of the United States, and as they would be the sole judges of the good or evil, it would be also a power to do whatever evil they please. It is an established rule of construction, where a phrase will bear either of two meanings, to give it that which will allow some meaning to the other parts of the instrument, and not that which would render all the others useless. Certainly no such universal power was meant to be given them. It was intended to lace them up strictly within the enumerated powers." End quote. The idea is captured well in Taylor Caldwell's A Pillar of Iron, when Cicero makes the following observation about the general welfare term in ancient Roman law. Quote, "Though liberty is established by law, we must be vigilant, for liberty to enslave us is always present under that very liberty. Our Constitution speaks of the general welfare of the people. Under that phrase, all sorts of excesses can be employed by lusting tyrants to make us bondsmen." End quote. But contrary to all of the foregoing, about a century and a half later, during the Great Depression, the U.S. Supreme Court disregarded Madison and Jefferson and effectively ruled that the taxing and spending power is not limited to the specific powers delegated to Congress under Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Recently, the court said that the Affordable Care Act, sometimes referred to as Obamacare, was constitutional by virtue of the taxing and spending power. Basically, today, nobody even tries to call into question the federal government's taxing and spending powers. Through strings money, it can buy virtually any state action it desires. In the words of Eric McKinley Erickson, quote, "When the states stand in front of the federal government with their hands stretched out and palms up," end quote, we can see a collective application of Hamilton's observation that, quote, "In the general course of human nature, a power over a man's subsistence amounts to a power over his will," end quote. In other words, in the context of federalism, Hamilton's observation could be changed to read, quote, "In the general course of human nature, a power over a state's subsistence amounts to a power over its people's will," end quote. Major subheading, whatever happened to the 10th Amendment? When he later drafted the Bill of Rights, Madison felt inclined to drive home the idea of limited federal authority in the language of the 10th Amendment, which reads, quote, "The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states respectively or to the people," end quote. Because it is part of the Constitution itself, it is the clearest and most authoritative declaration of federalism and the limited delegated powers concept. Appropriately, it is found in the section whose purpose is to protect individuals from the federal government, namely, the Bill of Rights. But as we will see later, the 10th Amendment has virtually been read out of the Constitution by the Supreme Court. Jefferson observed, quote, "I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states or to the people," in other words, the 10th Amendment. He continued, "To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specifically drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible to any definition, end quote. Can anyone seriously deny that his prediction has come true? Major subheading, Hamilton's views were different than some might think today. Even Alexander Hamilton, who is credited with expansive visions of federal powers, spoke in terms of strict limitation in describing the federal powers. In Federalist No. 29, he pointed out that the Necessary and Proper Clause allows the federal government to execute its declared powers. But to avoid the implication that that clause allows the federal government to do anything it pleases, he made a case for being reasonable in interpreting the powers delegated to Congress. If Congress operated outside of its declared powers, the Necessary and Proper Clause would not stand alone in validating the federal powers thus assumed. Said Hamilton, quote, "The laws of Congress are restricted to a certain sphere, and when they depart from this sphere, they are no longer supreme or binding. In the same manner, the states have certain independent powers in which their laws are supreme. For example, in making and executing laws concerning the punishment of certain crimes, such as murder, theft, etc., the states cannot be controlled." End quote. Hamilton also wrote Federalist 78, which takes a very limited view of the role of the federal judiciary. This will be discussed in more detail in the next lecture. In Federalist No. 33, Hamilton clarifies that the Necessary and Proper Clause was designed to effect the execution of the laws properly passed on the basis of the enumerated powers delegated to the federal government. Thus, he said the phrase was perfectly harmless. He said that laws passed pursuant to these delegated powers become the supreme law of the land, but that those that were not passed pursuant to those delegated powers would not become the supreme law of the land. In Federalist No. 32, he said, quote, "The state governments would clearly retain all the rights of sovereignty which they before had, and which were not, by the Constitution, exclusively delegated to the federal government." End quote. Hamilton continued, quote, "All authorities of which the states are not explicitly divested in favor of the Union remain with them in full vigor," end quote. And he also said, quote, "An attempt on the part of the national government to abridge them," the states, "in the exercise of their power to tax, and by implication all their other retained sovereign powers, would be a violent assumption of power unwarranted by any article or clause of the Constitution," end quote. Today, we have justified social welfare payments that now exceed our spending on national defense. This is the exact reverse of what Hamilton envisioned. He said the costs of national military expenses of government, quote, "are insignificant in comparison with those which relate to national defense," end quote. So even though the Hamiltonian view is often presented as the basis for arguing in favor of expansive federal powers, the foregoing quotation should give one pause to consider what he really believed. Major subheading, Chief Justice John Marshall's view. Chief Justice John Marshall was easily the most prolific writer of opinions in the early years of the Supreme Court. In asserting the Supreme Court's power to nullify a legislative act as being unconstitutional, he observed on behalf of a unanimous Supreme Court, quote, "To what purpose are powers limited, and to what purpose is that limitation committed to writing, if those limits may at any time be passed by those intended to be restrained? The Constitution is either a superior paramount law, unchangeable by ordinary means, or it is an absurd attempt on the part of the people to limit a power in its own nature illimitable." The framers of the Constitution contemplated that instrument as a rule for the government of the court as well as the legislature, end quote. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court's interpretations of the Constitution over the passing decades have effectively turned it into merely an absurd attempt on the part of the people to limit federal power, which, as we have seen, appears to be, quote, "in its own nature illimitable," end quote. Major subheading, what should be handled at the federal level and what at the state level? This issue has to be considered in both the positive and negative contexts. Following the mandate of the 10th Amendment, first, we ask ourselves what positive powers were delegated to the federal government. Then we ask if the Constitution prohibits a particular power at either the federal or state level, or both. Finally, whatever has not been specifically delegated to the National Congress, nor prohibited to the states, is reserved to the states as the ultimate default rule. Let us consider the positive delegations of power to the federal government. Generally speaking, those things which require that we speak and or act with one unified national voice are prime candidates for federal control. Among other, things that fit into this category would be declarations of war, making treaties with other countries, the coinage of money, regulating commerce between the states, Indian tribes, and with foreign countries, Remember the interstate commerce problems discussed in the first lecture? Anyway, setting weights and measures, creating and protecting patents and copyrights, etc. These are all found among the specific positive powers delegated to Congress under Article 1, Section 8. Then everything falling outside the list of the specific powers contained in Article 1, Section 8 is positively reserved to the states for their respective determinations unless it is negated by a specific prohibition somewhere within the constitutional text. Article 1, Section 9 lists specific prohibitions against the federal government, and Article 1, Section 10 lists specific prohibitions against the state governments. Moreover, Article 4 imposes further mandates and prohibitions on the states as discussed earlier. For example, consider bills of attainder. These are legislative as opposed to judicial pronouncements of guilt. And ex post facto laws. These are laws making something that was legal when done illegal retroactively. Both the federal government and the states are prohibited from passing such laws. Absent a constitutional amendment taking away such prohibitions, no level of government can constitutionally pass such laws, no matter how high the Democratic majorities are who want them. They have been taken out of the normal democratic realm. Why would anything be specifically prohibited like that? As one scans the list of prohibitions, including the two explained in the prior paragraph, at least two separate ideas come to mind. Either one, the fundamental wrongness or injustice of something, or two, the propensity for some type of significant societal harm associated with a particular government act, was sufficiently perceived by a supermajority of the people as to justify creating a constitutional prohibition against it, which would be immune to reversal by simple majority vote at either the federal or state level. Successful reversals could only properly come about through the formal supermajoritarian nationwide amendment process set forth in the Constitution. So, for example, if a supermajority of Congress and the state legislatures across the nation perceived a fundamental wrongness and/or significant societal harm associated with gay marriages, passing a constitutional amendment restricting marriage to one man and one woman would not violate either the spirit or the letter of the notion of federalism. We would simply be adding something to the lists of prohibitions contained in Article 1, Sections 9 and 10. Federalism is simply the sharing of powers and/or prohibitions between the federal and state governments. And how that sharing ultimately shakes out is only properly determined democratically through supermajority vote, either through the original adoption of the Constitution itself or the formal amendment process. What would violate the notion of federalism, however, would be for the courts to make undemocratic changes in the sharing arrangement regarding powers and prohibitions rather than the people themselves. Unfortunately, this the courts have done with reckless abandon. And it was from an apprehension that they were about to put on a repeat performance in forcing the acceptance of gay marriage upon the states that a constitutional amendment was proposed to head them off at the pass. Many argued there was no need for a constitutional amendment and that the institution of marriage could be protected simply by way of federal legislation. As a result, the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, was passed, which defined marriage for purposes of applying various federal laws as being between one man and one woman. That act seemed to suspend any active attempt to amend the Constitution regarding the definition of marriage. However, in 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court did what many conservatives expected and declared DOMA to be unconstitutional. At the same time, it effectively held in place two lower federal court rulings that California's Proposition 8 was unconstitutional because of the Equal Protection and Due Process clauses of the 14th Amendment. Through Proposition 8, the people of California, through democratic processes, tried to amend their state constitution to define marriage in the traditional way, but effectively the federal court said they couldn't do that. Even though the U.S. Supreme Court did not go so far as to explicitly agree with the holding of the lower federal courts as to why Proposition 8 was supposedly unconstitutional, it allowed their rulings to stand simply because it said the plaintiffs did not have any standing to bring the case to the Supreme Court, since neither the governor nor the attorney general from California was willing to defend Proposition 8 in federal court. When the elected representatives of another state are willing to actively defend their state laws defining marriage in the traditional sense, I fully expect the Supreme Court to specifically agree with the equal protection and due process arguments the lower courts used in the Perry case. In his dissenting opinion in the Windsor case, which overruled DOMA, Justice Scalia similarly predicted, quote, "As far as this court is concerned, no one should be fooled. It is just a matter of listening and waiting for the other shoe to drop." by formally declaring anyone opposed to same-sex marriage as an enemy of human decency, the majority arms well every challenger to a state law restricting marriage to its traditional definition, end quote. This is yet another example of how the court's misinterpretation of the 14th Amendment self-aggrandizes the federal government and diminishes the state governments in violation of traditional notions of federalism. Major subheading, why are some so condescending toward the idea of states' rights under federalism? First off, their tune would quickly change if the Supreme Court started ruling against their minority political positions, rather than imposing them from the bench onto the majority of the people. Were that the case, they would quickly become converts and start clamoring very loudly for states' rights, in hopes that in some state, somewhere, their minority political views could bear sway. But so long as the Supreme Court has been willing to impose those political views onto the whole nation through judicial activism, those on the winning side have heaped nothing but scorn and contempt upon the idea of states' rights. Imagine what would happen if the Supreme Court were to give every fetus a constitutional right to life, making it impossible for any woman to ever have an abortion unless her life were seriously at stake. Were the shoe on the other foot in the pro-life slash anti-abortion camp, getting the court to undemocratically impose its political will on everybody, like the pro-choice slash pro-abortion camp has, certainly the pro-abortion camp would be making all the same philosophical arguments made in this lecture to argue against such a state of affairs, and they would be correct to do so. But apparently they are willing to look the other way and ignore the violations of basic constitutional principles so long as they continue to get their way through such violations, justifying such things under some sort of utilitarian, the ends justifies the means, rationale. But as discussed above, the court should not be any sort of public policymakers favoring one side or the other. The battles over public policy should play out in democratic rather than judicial venues. Second, the argument is made that we cannot trust the states to make the correct calls. After all, didn't some states allow slavery? Yes, but that sounds like the argument, once wrong, always wrong, which is never logically true, for if it were, none of us would ever be qualified to express a legitimate opinion about anything, since we have all at one time or another been wrong concerning something. The past does not always equal the future. If people in the states were so profoundly and perpetually stupid, how come they were smart enough to send delegates to the Constitutional Convention and vote for the adoption of the Constitution in the first place, creating the federal government? If they were so incompetent, how could they have had enough foresight to demand as a condition of their adoption that the Constitution itself be amended soon thereafter in order to add the Bill of Rights? Remember how Hamilton and the majority of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention thought that was a bad idea? So the people in the states were smarter than even the drafters on this issue. In arguing for the necessity of a Bill of Rights in the proposed federal constitution, a New York anti-federalist writing under the pen name of Brutus observed that the same selfish human tendency of man to victimize and abuse his fellow man in a state of nature would likewise motivate him to take advantage of those over whom he is set to govern in a political capacity within organized societies. Thus he argued that the federal constitution should include express limitations and protections against such potential abuse and follow the prior lead of the states in their own constitutions. Said he, quote, in all the constitutions of our states, there is not one of them but what is either founded on a declaration or bill of rights or has certain express reservation of rights interwoven in the body of them, end quote. Consider too the issue of free speech. Were there no protections of speech in the states before or after the adoption of the Bill of Rights? Certainly not. At least 10 of the first 14 states to adopt the Constitution had laws guaranteeing freedom of speech. Obviously, they themselves had already thought about the idea and wanted to make sure that similar limitations apply to the federal government. So they were pretty smart after all. Besides, if a few mistakes like slavery should be enough to strip the states of all decision-making and rulemaking authority in perpetuity, what should be done when we find the federal government committing its own fair share of mistakes? Should we strip it of all such authority too? The result would be utter chaos. Since humans are involved in the process, no political arrangement can truthfully promise infallibility. All we can hope to do is come up with an arrangement which optimizes our chances for success and provides the easiest methods of correction when errors are discovered. Where are we to find such a system? Our original constitutional framework, namely, federalism with a healthy dose of states' rights. Major subheading, what dangers do we face when the federal courts thwart democracy and create constitutional rights regarding divisive political issues. Basically, when the Supreme Court creates a new constitutional right, it takes the matter out of the democratic realm. It thwarts the normal democratic process of the people deciding for themselves from the bottom up which liberties to give up and which to retain. In Lawrence v. Texas, the case that invalidated Texas's anti-sodomy statute, the Supreme Court majority gave the following justifications for its actions. Quote, "Had those who drew and ratified the due process clauses of the Fifth Amendment or the 14th Amendment known the components of liberty and its manifold possibilities, they might have been more specific. They did not presume to have this insight. They knew times can blind us to certain truths, and later generations can see that laws once thought necessary and proper, in fact, serve only to oppress. As the Constitution endures, persons in every generation can invoke its principles to their own search for greater freedom. In all events, we think that our laws and traditions in the past half century are of most relevance here. These references show an emerging awareness that liberty gives substantial protection to adult persons in deciding how to conduct their private lives in matters pertaining to sex. History and tradition are the starting point, but not in all cases the ending point, of the substantive due process inquiry," end quote. In other words, in their opinion, the greatest political minds of our founding generation, and perhaps any generation, were deficient when it came to an understanding of the proper limits and extents of liberty. And it is up to a majority of the 9 members of the Supreme Court to correct their folly in a permanent fashion by conjuring up a new constitutional right with no resort whatsoever to the will of the people as a whole. Since the court said that the, quote, "Texas statute furthers no legitimate state interest," end quote, and serves, quote, "only to oppress," end quote, they in effect concluded there is no fundamental moral law involved regarding homosexual conduct, and that no negative social impacts can possibly occur because of it. And they were so confident in their suppositions as to feel justified in second-guessing everybody, past, present, and future, in such a way as to make it virtually impossible for future generations to ever second-guess them on those judgments. After all, when one generation expresses its public policy preferences legislatively, it is relatively easy for future generations to democratically change those preferences by subsequent legislation. But not so when the Supreme Court expresses its own personal policy preferences in monolithic fashion through self-created, quote, "constitutional rights," end quote. Such rights can only be reversed by a constitutional amendment, which is virtually impossible to achieve, or by the Supreme Court reversing its own prior judgment on the matter, which also is highly improbable. Thus, ordinary democracy is trumped, thwarted, and eliminated in the process. Would somebody please point out where the Constitution sets up a government ruled by judicial oracles? Again, except regarding those express prohibitions against the state set forth in the Constitution, the issue at hand not being one of them, the right to determine the appropriate trade-offs between liberty and law rests with the people in their respective states and not with the U.S. Supreme Court. While a majority of only 9 individuals on the Supreme Court may conclude that unlimited liberty is the only way to go, like they did in Lawrence, most Americans probably would not. But apparently their democratic judgment doesn't matter anymore, since a majority of these 9 unelected people say that their will should permanently reign supreme on this matter. That is usurpation, plain and simple. According to the logic of the framers and the political structure they erected, whether one personally agrees or disagrees with the idea of a state law outlawing sodomy, or abortion, pornography, strip joints, etc., Texans have the ultimate self-regulatory right under the 10th Amendment to decide these matters for themselves. It shouldn't matter whether people outside of Texas agree or disagree with their decisions. Were a majority of Texans to believe that any of their laws were unjustified and, quote, "served only to oppress," end quote, they would certainly be free to repeal them through the normal democratic process within their own state. But to have the U.S. Supreme Court do it for them and everybody else in the country is constitutionally unjustifiable, at least if the written Constitution really means anything other than bald judicial whim. When legal and political error is created democratically, the losing side in the debate can afford to be magnanimous and play the role of gracious losers, since they know that democratic political winds can change quite quickly and dramatically in their favor at any moment, especially if their arguments are sound. Their angers and frustrations are more easily manageable in that context than in one where the Supreme Court declares their side to be permanent losers in the contest by the creation of a virtually untouchable constitutional right. Being on the losing end of that political battle tends to produce a deeper level of anger, frustration, and resentment that can even change what once were gracious losers into revolutionaries. Again, this is why, within the bounds set forth in the Constitution, the people themselves, and not judges, should be the ones who determine the appropriate balance between liberty and law at any particular point in time and at any particular place. Major subheading: Federalism allows for many different experiments. Contrary to what the modern Supreme Court has been doing as discussed above, our founders originally decided to solve Washington's dilemma about which liberties to give up and which to retain by specifically delegating limited decision-making authority to the federal government and reserving all other authority to the people of the various states. This makes sense, since reasonable people can disagree about the appropriateness of making trade-offs between competing societal goals. They have different value systems. They assess the relative importance of things differently. They assess interconnected cause and effect relationships differently regarding things that have happened in the past. They foresee the future consequences of things differently, and they differ as to whether only direct and immediate consequences should be considered in deciding what the law should be versus indirect and delayed consequences, etc. By allowing the states to democratically decide most matters for themselves, we allow many different experiments throughout the country, the results of which can be compared to see what works best. Through this comparative process, public policy blunders can be caught and corrected relatively easily. By contrast, at the federal level, such blunders would be harder to detect and correct. For one thing, when a one-size-fits-all approach is mandated from above, little contradictory evidence can be amassed to show the imprudence of that approach, since no competing experiments are allowed to take place. And massive institutional inertia at the national level is always very hard to change, compared to the smaller inertial masses at the state level. Tyrannical government at the state or local level is far easier to cope with than tyranny at the federal level. If corrective efforts fail, it's easy to flee a local tyranny, but not a federal one. In the former case, people can move around the country to whatever legal system suits them best, without having to forfeit their treasured American citizenship. By contrast, a federal tyranny is much harder to cope with. If it cannot be changed, then one has but three choices, namely 1, endure it, 2, forfeit his or her American citizenship and emigrate, or 3, revolt. In short, our founders' political model of federalism was pure genius for allowing a very diverse nation to cope with deep-seated religious, philosophic, and political differences. The Supreme Court has done great violence to this wonderful plan handed down to us from our forefathers. In determining its proper role in our constitutional scheme, rather than merely paying lip service, it should really take what it once said to heart, namely, quote, "The question is not what power the federal government ought to have, but what powers, in fact, have been given by the people," end quote. The next chapter will explore more deeply the proper role of the judiciary. See you then.